So the reason we're doing John, okay, is because John, there's really no reason. Right now I'm actually prepping for a series. And so during the summer, we just finished a year and a half long series through the book of Acts. And because we were finished with that series, I wanted to take some time to kind of just work through getting ready for the next season. And as we're getting ready, one of the texts that have been coming up constantly in my life is the text of the Gospel of John, which is one of the four original accounts of Jesus' life. And John, specifically, was the one that our international students community on Friday nights has been studying. We just finished the series, it's called, and it was going through John. And another group that was doing it was also CCF, which is a Chinese community of young adults and college students. And they are actually currently working through, I think, chapter 5 of John in that group as well. So there's like two or three different groups in our church that have been going through John in this season. And as a result, I've been reading John personally as well. And because I've been reading John and I've been studying and praying it, it's been like a really big blessing to me, especially through my season of cancer. It's been one of those books I've just been reading just to enjoy and study. And because of that, as I've read it, quite a few times already. And when you read John, when you first read it, it's kind of, oh, it's a story, it's an account. But the more you read it, what happens is you start to peel back and you start to see different things. It's kind of like whenever you read any book, the first time you read, like, it's kind of weird, but if you read Harry Potter, right, you first read it, you kind of just get through the story. You want to know the story. But then as you read it again, or Lord of the Rings again and again, you start to gather new, maybe points, new intentions, new purposes, little details that you may not have noticed. And in the same way, I think John has been teaching me a lot of new things as I've been studying it again and again. And I want you to see that John, when he wrote this letter or wrote this book, his purpose, his intention is very different. And what he wanted us to see was that Jesus is like no one you've ever met before. That Jesus, this person named Jesus, he will not fit your expectations. Whatever you have thought of who Jesus is and what he stands for, he is absolutely not like that. Okay? He is actually more, or if anything, way different from your expectations. And when we first come to see Jesus in the story of the Gospels, in John 2 specifically, I know you don't have your text in front of you, but if you did have it, it's, you know, you guys have the red pew Bible. Some of the people have the red Bible. Where's the red Bible? Does someone have it? What page is John chapter 2 on? Yeah, that's perfect. If you have that version, it's 1066. Perfect. And if you have the darker red one, is that a light red one or a dark red one? There's like two different versions for some reason. Same? Okay. If you have a dark red, it's 1066. But if you want to follow along, 1066, okay, on that Bible, the one that's at church. And if you don't have one, raise your hand. Love to pass you one. Just to help you follow what I'm talking about. Do some people not have a Bible? Can someone help the people in the back that might not have one? Real quick. Pass them a small Bible. And bring them to John. And the reason, I'm not trying to make people feel left out. I want everybody to be part of this study together. I don't want you to be excluded. Some people have it on their phones, but not everybody does. I actually prefer using the book, right? So I totally feel you. But if you don't have one, it's good to follow along. So let's do that for a second. And the best thing about this is, if this is your first time here, or you've never come, I just had this conversation with someone, and I said, if you're going to leave and you have one time to study with me the Word, okay, then I hope that at least the one time you were here with me, you learned something that you can always say you know at least one part of the Bible, okay? That's why I want you to look at the text. Anyways, so I was going to do John chapter 2, 1 to 12, because I've been really enjoying the text. But then I was talking to someone, and 13 to 25 really caught my heart. And so what I want to kind of explain is what is going on in John chapter 2, 1 to 12. That's why I want you to follow, is that the very first sign that Jesus shows, okay, which always makes me laugh, okay, the first sign John uses is he uses at a wedding party. At a party, at a celebration, Jesus turns water to wine. His first sign is to make alcohol. And you're like, what? Why does John, and the first thing he does is to make alcohol in a party, right? From water to wine. And he doesn't just make wine. He makes the best wine. It's the wine that's so good. They're like, dang, dude, this wine, why did you save this till the last? You should usually give it to people when they're sober so that when they're drunk, they can drink the cheaper wine and they can't tell the difference, right? But here, what John, I think, was trying to show was that you think that your ways are good. Your old ways were the good ways. It was like the good wine. You already bought good wine. You served it. But then you ran out. But I bring something that's way better. I bring a wine that tastes so much better, that's so good. It's like the old ways, and I bring something even better, even newer. And that's what he's doing. He was challenging their thinking, their presuppositions, their assumptions of what it means to follow God, to serve God. And he was using wine to paint a picture, which is hilarious to me. And I think that was just interesting. So then it gets to the second sign. And the second sign is our text today, which is John chapter 2, verses 13 to 25. And then there's two questions that comes up when you're reading this text, okay? First of all, most of us read it, we're like, what's going on? Now, some of us have read this multiple times. It's about the temple. And you're like, oh, temple. What's the temple? It's kind of like the church of their time. It was the most important religious place of their time. It was the seat of their power, the authority, the worship, their focus of worship was all in this temple. And then in this story, you see Jesus get mad. You see Jesus get upset. So the first thing you see, you have to ask yourself, is why is Jesus so mad? Isn't he supposed to be a paragon of excellence, of holiness, like an example of holiness? But rather than being holy, he seems so upset. Why does Jesus get so mad? Like, bro, why are you mad? You know? First question. And then the second question is, he doesn't trust anyone. He says here, he doesn't want to entrust himself to those that are there. So the two questions you have to ask is, why is Jesus so mad? And why is Jesus not trusting anyone with anything? And these are just two questions that make you think, why is God such a hard, like, this is so unlikely for supposedly the Savior or Jesus to be like this. Isn't Jesus supposed to be a person that never gets upset? Isn't he a person that is trusting? Isn't he honor and tell us to trust people and trust, be trusting and loving, right, welcoming? And so those two questions is kind of what we're going to look at today as we look at this text, okay? So my points today are basically, the title is called The New Passover, and I'll flesh out why. And it's the first point is, I'm just going to go through our 3 points so you know the layout of how I'm going to guide you. It's like a roadmap. First point is corrupted worship. Second is corrupted belief. And lastly, uncorrupted salvation. And so corrupted worship, corrupted belief, uncorrupted salvation. So we're going to start with corrupted worship. So I want you guys to understand, what is the setting? It says here, Jesus shows up at Jerusalem, in the city of Jerusalem, during a very important special celebration. It's a week-long celebration called the Passover. And you have to ask yourself then, what is the Passover? Because if you don't know the context, you won't know what's going on, okay? What is the Passover? It is one of the most special moments, special ceremonies and celebrations of the Jewish people, of Israel. Historically, in Israel, this was the time where they remember their escape from Egypt, from slavery. You guys know this story from Prince of Egypt, from Ten Commandments. You guys ever watch that? People watch that? Let my people go, you know? Right? And there's like the Whitney Houston, Mariah Carey song, right? Pretty awesome. But this is the story of Passover. And the idea of Passover, is actually the idea of the 10th plague, which is the judgment of God over the people, the Egyptians, because they refused to let Israel go. It was the final judgment. It was the judgment where a spirit of judgment came over Egypt and took away the firstborn of all the people, except for the people that killed a Passover lamb, killed a lamb and spread the blood of the lamb on their door jamb, basically, on their door frame. And by spreading it on, it was kind of a sign that this place has been paid for, the blood has been paid for, the judgment has been paid for. And as a result, this judgment passed over them. But the judgment fell on the Egyptians who didn't use that blood thing. And so what happens is they were able then, the Egyptians released the Israelites to run, to flee. And so the Israelites fled away from their slavery. And they were able to cross the Red Sea, you know, the river parted, the sea parted. And so that's the idea of Passover. It's a memory, it's a celebration of a victory, of the time when God saved Israel from certain lifelong slavery and death and brought them salvation. And so that is the celebration. In Jerusalem, the city would be about, at this point, in this time, about 80,000 people normally. But during the Passover, they would have increased up to 300,000 to 500,000 people. So there's a lot of people in Israel, in Jerusalem at that moment because of this holiday. It's such an important holiday that people from all over that were of Jewish background, who honored God, who wanted to honor God, would come to this one place to celebrate the Passover because it was so important a holiday. I would say, what is the really important holiday in America? Like July 4th, right? But July 4th, it's one of those times when everybody gets together to do something, right? I would say it's kind of similar. It's a very big moment in the history of Israel. And then what happens is Jesus here, it shows, has a problem with this. He has a problem with the Passover. Why? It's because at the temple, it's crowded. In the first layer of the temple, there's all this marketplace stuff going on. Animals, there's money changers, and Jesus gets angry. And you have to ask, why is he so angry about this? Because if you know the history, these were actually parts of the temple that were necessary. Like during the Passover, okay, when you come to sacrifice, you need an animal to sacrifice. People traveling from far away, they're not going to be like, they don't have a supermarket, right? They're not going to go like to some supermarket and pick up some lamb shank or something, right? They're going to literally go, they need to bring, either they bring the lamb from wherever they came from, or they're just going to buy it there because it's convenient. And then the other thing is, they need to specifically switch the money so they can support the temple. It's a temple tax. So how do you get the money that they need to support it? Is you exchange money. So those two purposes were meant to be there to help people make it convenient to do the celebrate the Passover. And that's the reason why it's a good thing. But the problem was, and what Jesus was seeing, was that there's three layers to this. The temple itself has multiple layers. The closer you get to the inside is the holiest place where only God is. People couldn't get close to that. The second layer would have been like the priests and those that were like of Jewish male origin. They were like a holy, like priesthood. And then the third layer would have been mostly the general public, including people that weren't Jewish. And what I think Jesus saw here was that this was the third layer was actually meant to be a place of worship, had become a marketplace. And there's a loss of focus. It's basically, it was meant for God, but it had become corrupted by the noise and loudness of trade. And this is bad. And I think this is why Jesus is so upset, okay? But if you read in verse 18, it says here, the Jews' leadership, they said to them, what sign do you show us for doing these things? And basically, they're not, I wouldn't say they're super upset because I think they know why Jesus is doing what he's doing. But they're saying, prove to us that you have a right to tell us what to do. Show us that you have an authority. But basically what Jesus is trying to say is this place was meant for one thing. It was meant to be set apart to honor God, meant to be a place to devote yourself to God, to fully focus on God. And basically these authorities had allowed these disruptions, these noises, these good things to come in and basically hinder people from worshiping God. It basically didn't allow them to worship God. And that leads me to the question then, what could we learn from this today? The first thing I want to offer to you is this thought, is how often are good things in your life? Good things can be things that aren't bad on paper. Like honestly, there's a lot of things that are good for you, right? But how often can those things become so loud and so disruptive in your life that they interfere with your relationship with God? I think there are a lot of things, okay? I don't want to like go into it too deeply and say, oh, everything you do is wrong. But I think that's a struggle for many people. It's not bad things. It's not like, I killed someone, so I shouldn't honor God. Most people don't kill people. People don't even rob people most of the time. Mostly, it's the small things. It's the things that are actually pretty okay, right? It could be your family, right? You value your family so much that it becomes a disruption to honoring God. It just becomes so loud in your life that you don't see God. It could be your academics. It could be your success in your academics. It could be your career success. Pursuing career could be so much more important to you that you lose sight of putting God first. These are not bad things. It's not bad to pursue certain things, right? Relationships are not bad. You're called to be married, right? But the problem is when it becomes so loud, they overarchingly take over your life. And I think one of the things Jesus sees here, what upsets him, is that our worship has been so corrupted, so convoluted by all these things, this noise, this disruption. And so he challenges, and I think John does, is challenges our definition of worship. He says, your worship today has been corrupted. It's been polluted. Okay? First point, done. Good? You following me? Okay, I'm moving. All right, corrupted belief. So then here's another layer. So as I read this book, I was like, man, that's pretty cool, right? I'm thinking through it, and I read, I get to the bottom. And as I'm reading, I look at another layer. I go, dang, God's telling me something else. And the question then you look at as you read verse 24, 25 is this. Jesus doesn't trust himself to anyone because he knew all people and needed no one to bear witness about man, for he himself knew what was in man. And what was in man that was so bad then? What was in person, in us, or in the people he saw that he didn't trust? What was that? And the first thing I want you to see is when you look at verse 18 and verse 23, it talks about signs. It says, The Jews said to him, "What sign do you show us for doing these things?" Right? And then in verse 23, it says, when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs that he was doing. The first thing I want you to see is that they wanted a sign to validate Jesus. What they needed to see, okay, and what their faith of Jesus was wrapped around a need to see miracles and displays of power. They needed to see God, Jesus do something for them to believe. Show me your power, then I will believe in you. Okay, that's what basically they're saying. But why is this bad? And what I offer to you is because they wanted Jesus to be king. Don't keep previewing my stuff. to be king, but not king of their hearts. Not to be king of their hearts. And why is this bad? It is because I think the best way to say it is that it's faith based on conditions. It's based on conditions. It's the idea that I will only believe if you show me something I can believe. God, you have to fit my understanding or else I won't believe you. If you don't fit my understanding, my definition, I can't believe in you because you haven't shown me proof. So what that means is it's a faith wrapped around their expectation. It's wrapped around their understanding. It has to be. If it's not, then I can't believe. But the problem with this perspective is that if you want a God that you can understand and you can grasp, then he is only as big as your experience and as your knowledge. And if he's only as big as your knowledge or your experience, then he's just an extension of your imagination, your understanding. A God worthy of our worship has to be bigger than our understanding. He has to be so much bigger than us that we cannot comprehend. His decisions, his will, have to be greater than ours. If we could say, oh, I understand everything Jesus is doing or God's doing, then what kind of God is that? It's not a God I would blow my mind. Basically, he does what I want to do. That's not a God that is infinitely great. If you believe in a God that is infinitely great, then he has to be a God that is greater than your comfort level. Your comfort level is shaped by your bias, by your worldviews, by your experience. But if it's bigger, it has to be a God that can challenge you and demand more from you and see the world in a bigger way than you could ever imagine. Okay? And so when you want a God that shows, has to show you signs, what you're really asking for is a God that's just you. It's an extension of you. And so what the problem is it's a matter of control. So not only is it an extension of you wanting to control who God is the fact that you want a God that looks like you, that you understand. And that means basically in many ways you become your own God because it's the God you choose to have. And I think the only way you really can understand God, I think as Christians, I don't think Christians are any better than non-Christians at understanding who God is. No way, okay, not at all, right? But if there is a God out there, he has to be bigger than our understanding. There's questions that we don't always have to answer. We don't have the explanation for. And it takes a faith. It takes a faith that trusts in certain things. It doesn't mean that we don't think through things. It just means that there's some things that we just simply don't have an answer for. And I think Israel in this time, they had lost connection with God. Because rather than seeing God as the focus, okay, one to worship, they basically had made the temple their focus, honoring God and doing all these things. The priesthood, all these little details seemed to be more important than really, really pursuing God himself, the Holy One. So they would rather pursue holiness than the Holy One. They were so caught up with doing the things than honoring God fully and wanting to know him. And I think what Jesus challenges basically, and what John is trying to show is that it's not what you do, right? Not just your understanding. You can't be in control. You can't be in control. The temple, he even says, basically, the temple can't be your place of confidence. Because if you read in verse 19, he goes, you know what? Jesus basically answered them. He says, show us a sign. And Jesus in verse 19 says, destroy the temple. In 3 days, I'm going to raise it up. And they're like, what is this guy talking about? So it took us 46 years to build this temple, right? And they're looking at him like, and you're going to do it in 3 days? Are you crazy? And in verse 21, he says, but he was speaking about the temple of his body. Now, basically, he was saying was what I'm going to do is so different, so radical, you've never seen it before. You think it's a building. It has nothing to do with the building. It's never nothing ever to do with the building. And that leads me to my next question for you guys. What happens when the temple that you worship at, whatever temple it is, it doesn't have to be God's temple, but whatever temple you worship at is destroyed? What happens? What would you go to? If you put everything, your confidence, in a temple, what happens when you all that faith that you put into it is disappears? It's all gone. What happens? What happens when you lose that control, that power? Because 60 or 20, 30 years later, this temple is destroyed. This temple becomes, you know, when you see the Western Wall in the news in Israel, still Jerusalem, there's still the one remaining wall. It's just the one last wall remaining from this burned down temple. That's all that's left, right? All their hope was in this building, in this temple, this source. And Jesus says, what if that is gone? You can't put your confidence in something that took 46 years to build. It has to be in something greater. You see, when you go through hard stuff, okay, when you go through hard stuff, whatever hard stuff, it's only in those times when you're tested that you're really going to see what you really believe in. Every time else, it's just theory. Look, I talk about this a lot, so I know the people here that have known me heard this a lot. So I'm going through cancer treatment. I've been to chemo. I'm actually going through radiation. I'm 9 out of 20 treatments of radiation, which is half the dose, which I'm grateful for, but it's still horrible. There was a point where you have to ask yourself. I tell people, trust God through difficulties, illness. It's very different to go through it personally because it's just theory until you have to believe it and apply it in your own life. And that's why I talk about God so much more now. I talk about cancer, but I'm talking about God and how God did this to me, helped me, right? Because I believe it now. I really believe it. I lived it, right? And I think what happens when you have nothing that you can trust? Your body doesn't even trust. Like, I recently lost my taste. I can't taste anything. It's one of the most horrible things for a guy that loves food. It is like a curse. I tell people there's three curses in my life that I've experienced that I hate. One was when I have a tat. When I had a tat, I couldn't scratch. You can't scratch a tat when you just get it. It's like, gosh, dude, when you can't scratch an itch, that's one horrible torture. The other one would be when you can't eat and enjoy food that you love. I literally was eating South Coast Deli Mexican Chicken Caesar. It tasted like wet, soggy, I don't know, like napkin. That's the best way to say it. It was horrible, dude. It was like the horrible thing. That made me really sad. But what happens when you lose all those things? Who will you trust? And I think for us today, we believe the church, for some of us, we believe the church is our temple. We believe it's the place where we must come to worship God, that we have to do certain things, that there's a place, there's a process to stay holy and be with God. And I think that's how our beliefs are corrupted. For others, it's not the church, because you've never been to church before. Maybe it's not that you didn't go to church, it's just that you don't ever have an interest in church. But for some others, it's never been the church. So whatever it has been was something else. But what happens when those things are gone? What will you truly believe in? What will you be? And so deep down, it's a matter of control. Are you letting God control it and dictate it, or are you personally still in control? And I think those here, what Jesus is trying to say is that this control, if God has to conform to your understanding of who he is and what he does, then it's your way. Then really you're saying is, I'm in control. I don't want God to be in control. And I tell this to Christians too. If you want a God, right, God is not a God that just, you come to church, be nice, say all the right things, sing the right songs. It doesn't make you a Christian either. What happens when you lose it all? Who do you really believe in? And so I think John here not only critiques and points out that there is a corrupted worship, but he's saying is that you're still corrupted even in your belief. Your belief system is corrupted. It's deeper down. There's an issue of your belief is being not healthy either. So it's not, if you treat the symptoms, it's just the outward stuff. It's the cancer that's deeper and darker in your soul. Okay? And so this leads me to my last point. What was actually in man that was so untrustworthy? If it says here that he didn't trust, and I said that it's because of signs, then what drives those signs? What inspires those signs? You have to ask that question. And I want you to understand is that the temple, what it was there for, was actually something God wanted them to have. He gave it to them. But the problem is, as man corrupts anything, man corrupts the temple. Traditionally, the temple was a place of worship. It was meant to be a good place to connect with God. But actually, let me clarify. The Jewish people couldn't even go in and connect with God directly. Only one person, once a year, could meet with God, and only for a brief time. And he had to be purified constantly. Purified constantly. And it's interesting because before the week before atonement, the guy would be separated. The priest, the chosen priest, would be of a specific family, super clean. He would spend a week praying and washing, praying and cleaning his mind, staying holy. And then he would go in. He would make a sacrifice. He would go into the Holy of Holies and make a sacrifice for his sins of himself, his own failures. Then he would come back out, clean again, go back in, sacrifice for the priests that he's serving with. And you go back out, clean again, bring a sacrifice, and kill another sacrifice for all of Israel. You understand? There's like multiple showers happening here. I mean, that's as clean as it gets, right? And the interesting thing is, when you read in Zechariah, there's a book in the Old Testament. It says in Zechariah chapter 3, Joshua is the high priest at the point. Zechariah, the author, was watching Joshua. He's seeing this vision. It says, Joshua was standing before the angel, clothed with filthy garments. And the angel said to those who were standing before him, remove the filthy garments from him. And to him he said, behold, I've taken your iniquity away from you. I will clothe you with pure vestments. Now, the filthy garments is dung covered. That's what it means, like poo covered. So that's actually how filthy he was. But this is Joshua, the high priest. So if he was meeting with God, he had already bathed multiple times and was wearing pure, fresh, white, never touched linen, right? Which is their dress code for then. And yet it was still filthy. What made him so filthy that even after bathing so many times, it was still so dirty? And what Zechariah realizes when he sees this vision is that no matter what we do, we are unfit and unable to be in the presence of a holy and perfect God. You see, the thing that we're talking about is the thing that corrupts the worship. It corrupts your belief systems. It's the idea in the darkness, the cancer of sin. Okay, it's what takes us from our worship of God. It's what makes us think that God must conform to our understanding. It's the idea that ultimately, okay, we want to run our own lives, pursue our own goals, pursue our own dreams, pursue our own glory, only without God. It's the fact that we want to be truly our own control. And deep down, we want to be our own God. And that often leads us to self-worship. This is why Jesus, when he sees the people, he says, I don't trust you guys, because I know that's what's ultimately in your heart. It's because you have something so dark and cancerous. It hinders you. It's corrupting you from the inside. So what happens? If that's corrupting us and that makes us so impure that even after multiple cleansings, even the highest priest, the one person that can meet with God, is still considered filthy, how can he even get close? Then how can we get close? How can we dare get close to God? And this is when you have to look at verse 20 to 22. In verse 20 to 22, it says, it took 46 years to build this. It will take you 3 days to raise it up again. And he was speaking about the temple of his body. When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered what he had said when he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. And what we come to understand here is that Jesus is not talking about a building. He's talking about himself. But later on, Jesus, in the same letter, in John chapter 14, okay, we're in John chapter 2. Further on, John fleshes it out. He says, Jesus even says this with these words. He says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. He says, I am the temple. I'm not only the temple, I am the priest. And not only am I the priest, I am the sacrifice. I am all three things. And what John is trying to show us is that he is the new way. He is the new way. This is something that would have, for us today, we're like, oh, who cares, right? But for the people then, the Jewish people, they would have blew their minds. They were like, we thought we had to go to this place. The only way we could even get kind of close to God, we have to come to this temple. We got to kill a bunch of animals just to get close. You know, Peter would have been pissed, right? But no, Jesus says, I am the way. I'm the only way. All you need is me, once and for all. If I die, if I sacrifice, my sacrifice will cover it all. And that's why this is so unique compared to other faiths. I'm not saying that other faiths are not have benefits or blessings in other ways. But what I see makes Jesus so unique and so worthy of worship is the fact that this. He doesn't come to tell you how to believe certain things. He doesn't say, oh, you need to believe in certain principles and therefore you can be a good person. Okay? It's not about rules. It's not about following certain things. He did not come to save ourselves. He did not come to help us save ourselves. Okay? He didn't just come to help us. He came to save us. I want you to understand the difference. He didn't just come to help us, give us tips and wisdom. Oh, you should do these things. You should be good then. No, he said, actually, you can't do anything to save yourself. I'm here to save you. I come, I give my life to die for you. You see, the only way this could happen is if Jesus lived a perfect life as both man and as God. And he has to experience it as a human being. He has to experience the temptations, the hardships, the struggles, the suffering, the desires to want to self-govern, to want to control his life. He has to experience that and yet always still choose God. And he did do that. And because he did that, his life was uncorrupted. But then, as you know the story, if some of you know the story, he goes to the cross because of false accusations. He's falsely accused. He's sent and imprisoned. Not only imprisoned, he's beaten, and then he's thrown, and then he's whipped, tortured. He had done nothing wrong, okay? And then he goes to the cross, which is one of the most horrible ways to die in Roman methods. And he dies at this unjust death, okay? And here's a detail I didn't think about. They didn't just kill him. They spit on him, they beat him, and it made him nasty. He didn't deserve it, which is already horrible. They took him to the dirtiest place they could take him. He had to carry his own cross to basically a garbage heap. That's where they took him and put him on a cross. He had to walk through that, and he was basically killed in a garbage dump, okay? It's one of the dirtiest places. But that's what Jesus does. Because when Jesus dies, he becomes the sacrifice, the true sacrifice, the Passover lamb for us. You see, with his death, our worship is no longer bound into a temple. It doesn't require the holy priesthood to do it, not those priests to do it. And it's not about signs. It's not about signs. It's all through Jesus. And it's not just that he died for us and took our sins and pushed and carried him onto the cross for us. But that our judgment was paid for. Our judgment was paid for. And therefore, our sins no longer are held accountable to us. See, someone has to pay for our mistakes, our failures. And each of us carries flaws. Someone had to pay for it. If we did it the old way, it would be like every few months we have to go, every year we have to go kill a lamb, kill a bird, kill an animal, say, man, I did this wrong. Kill for me. Clear my name. And what he says is, no, I will do it all. I will carry it all. And by dying for our sins, okay, it pays for our sins and our judgment. And as a result, as Christians, when you believe this, it promises you a new life because Jesus didn't just die. 3 days later, he rose again. And when he rose again, what it says is that death no longer holds him down. And so he's able to have a new life made holy, pure. And now you have a direct access to God. You have a relationship eternally with God once your physical life ends now. You see, the old Passover signifies slavery to Egypt and how freedom came through God. And what I think John is challenging here was not just that you have corrupted belief, corrupted worship. He's saying, but there's a different way. My way is the new Passover. My way is the way where Jesus has brought freedom to people that have been enslaved by sin. That's the reason it's a new Passover. And that's why in 1 Corinthians, Paul, another follower of Jesus, a missionary, says, for Christ, our Passover lamb has been sacrificed. So why do you come to church today? I think for some of us, maybe the first challenge is simply your worship has been convoluted. It's been corrupted, that you have good things in your life that have disrupted you from worship with God. This is probably more for Christians that understand what I'm saying, right? And I don't think it's always just the good things. Sometimes it's a deeper issue. Deeper because it's something that's in your belief system where you want to be in control and you don't want God to be in control. If it's that, then that's something that you need to work through with God. You need to believe in him. You need to want him and challenge your own perspectives of what it means to worship. And the funny thing about it is, when you go to the end of John, and I tell this to everybody who studies the Bible, John, everybody knows, like, Sam, you remember this, right? At the end of John, one fact you can take away today, you even forget everything I said. John tells you what his purpose of writing his paper. His thesis is given at the end of John chapter 20. In John chapter 20, verse 30-31, he says this. Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these that are written here, these signs that I'm showing you, these stories I've shown you, are written so that you as in the reader, may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. His greatest desire, John writes everything, is to present to you a new way. He's saying, this is the best way. This is the only way. This is the true way. This is better than anything you've ever seen. And he's using the context of the Jewish culture to speak about it at that point. And so hopefully today, as I've shared with you, you leave with this question. Will you believe? Because that's what John wants.